Welcome to Our Interesting Times with host Timothy Kelly, who interviews today's top alternative and revisionist thinkers.
May you live in interesting times.
Episode of Our Interesting Times. My guest this evening is Dr. Joseph P. Farrell. Dr. Farrell has a doctorate in patristics from the University of Oxford and pursues research in physics, alternative history, and science, and strange stuff. He's the author of many books in the field of alternative research, including The Giza Death Star, Reich of the Black Sun, The SS Brotherhood of the Bell, LBJ and the Conspiracy to Kill Kennedy, The Nazi International, and the most recent Rotten to the Common Core, Public Schooling, Standardized Tests, and the Surveillance State. His website is GizaDeathStar.com. Tonight, we're going to talk about a book that I think came out in the spring of this year, Hidden Finance, Rogue Networks, and Secret Sorcery, The Fascist International, 9/11, and Penetrated Operations. Dr. Farrell, how are you doing this evening?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming on. Is there anything you want to add to that bio or get that all
No,
out,
that
right?
pretty well covers
okay.
it.
And I just purchased your Common Core book, so I look forward to reading that. But right now, of course, tonight we want to talk about your book, Hidden Finance, Rogue Networks, and Secret Sorcery. This is a book about 9/11, but it's about so much more. It's sort of a culmination, or at least a kind of an extension of your previous work regarding some of this strange, kind of sort of the stateless organization, this post-war World War II organization, how it the Nazi International, how it affected, perhaps had an impact on 9/11. I guess how we want to start the conversation would be on 9/11. Perhaps I think you have a personal experience with 9/11 and how you first experienced it, like many people on the television, and you get into your theory with this is that not only is there a level one and level two, which would be the inside job, which would be what many 9/11 truth researchers touch on, you posit the theory of a level three, a fascist international.
Yes.
And I guess how to get into this, first let's talk about 9/11, how you experienced it, and get into each level, I guess, and let you take it from there and explain your book.
Well, at the time, I was a floor manager in a casino near Tulsa, Oklahoma. I was actually the ranking overnight graveyard shift floor manager. And I had just come off my shift in the morning, gone home. I had a friend staying with me at the time in the guest bedroom. And he was just getting up as I was just coming home and going to sleep. So I went to bed, and he got up and turned on the news, and all of a sudden, as I'm kind of dozing off, I'm hearing from the living room, "Oh my God, oh my God," over and over again. And so I finally got up, put on my bathrobe, and came into the living room and said, "What in the name of sense is going on?" He pointed to the television screen, and I looked. And just as I looked, you know, the North Tower of the World Trade Center was on fire. And just as I looked, the second tower was struck, the South Tower was struck. And immediately I thought, you know, we're under attack. So I stayed up and watched the towers come down. And I began to notice two things. Number one, the meme was already being put out by the what I like to call the lamestream media. That, you know, was there a possibility that the fires could so weaken the structures that they'd come down? And of course, I thought that's nonsense, you know, because for one thing, you know, you were looking at black smoke coming out of them. The fires were, in other words, they were cool fires. They weren't oxygen rich fires. So I thought immediately, well, that's nonsense. So there's something going on here. And then the towers came down, and I deliberately made myself count. You know, I used my hands to kind of physically count. And I thought, gee, that's near free fall speed. So this is not a conventional collapse. This is some sort of controlled demolition. And the way it looked to me, Tim, watching the towers kind of be peeled like a banana, I thought this is not a conventional controlled demolition. There may be some sort of exotic technology at work here. And then, of course, the Pentagon was struck, and we started hearing about, almost immediately, of course, about Osama bin Laden, that this was terrorism. And at that point, you know, having lived through the JFK assassination as a boy, and listening to the ridiculous explanations from the Warren Commission, I was immediately suspicious, I have to be quite honest with you. And I kind of bided my time for several years writing about 9/11 because as the story began to develop, it became very clear, thanks to the great research of so many in the 9/11 truth community, that there had to have been at some point a rogue element within the American national security structure that had either allowed it to happen or planned it to happen. And I actually lean towards the latter view, as a matter of fact. But as they began to speculate that this was a planned false flag operation in order to inject American power into the Middle East, you know, you heard the usual culprits, the Saudis were involved, the Israelis were involved, and so on and so forth. I began to get very suspicious even of that 9/11 truth narrative, because the destruction of the Twin Towers would not have been necessary to project American power into the Middle East. All that would have been necessary would have been to strike those targets, strike the Pentagon, and create the climate of public opinion. So in other words, the Twin Towers destruction appeared to me as a kind of overkill in order to accomplish the objective. So I began to think in terms of, well, instead of two levels to this operation, the public level of the terrorists flying airplanes into buildings, and the deeper level of some rogue element within the American national security structure, I began to entertain the idea that maybe what we're looking at here is an entirely penetrated operation, that there's a third level that may have revealed itself on 9/11 to the second level, and created the kind of bizarre responses that we saw in the federal government at that time. And let me give you, if I may, an analogy here of what I'm thinking and why I'm thinking it. Because in any crime, the usual solution that you go for, particularly a crime of murder, is you want to find out what the murder weapon was. And this is where it gets very interesting in terms of the 9/11 truth community, because there's basically four theories out there of what kind of controlled demolition was involved. And of course, the first and most popular theory within the 9/11 truth community was simple conventional explosive controlled demolition. And it's crucial here to understand that by identifying the murder weapon, you are to a certain extent able to narrow the list of culprits down. So controlled demolitions would have required building preparation and so on and so forth. And this is where they began to uncover links to the Bush family and the security firms that were involved in the security of the World Trade Center. Then the next theory to come down the pike was the nanothermite theory that was advanced by Dr. Stephen Jones on the basis of evidence that he had found in the rubble of the presence of nanothermite particles. And then there was another theory that was advanced, and that was the mini nuke theory. And then finally you had the exotic energy weaponry hypothesis, which incidentally is not solely Dr. Judy Woods. This was actually proposed almost a decade and 2 years ago, prior to her book coming out. So there were other people thinking along those lines. And I certainly was entertaining that hypothesis myself on the day of 9/11. So why is this important? Because if you look at the way that this question has been handled by the 9/11 truth community, this is where the debate has been the most acrimonious, because people have been arguing for a particular murder weapon that would point to a particular group of people that would have access to the technology and able to deploy it and operate it with competence. The trouble is they've all been operating with the implicit assumption that there's only one party involved and therefore only one murder investigation. So you get these terribly acrimonious debates between the defenders of each of those four hypotheses, when if you step back and look at the evidence for each of them, they've all got their strengths and they've all got their weaknesses. The conventional controlled demolitions crowd cannot explain the presence of nanothermite. The nanothermite crowd cannot explain the post-catastrophe presence of high heat in the area and of radioactive isotopes that are not normal background presence for these isotopes. So some sort of nuclear event was involved, be it a mini nuke or some sort of exotic energy weaponry that might have been able to create some of these isotopes. The problem with the mini nuke people is they can't really explain why you have all of these bizarre toasted cars that Dr. Wood and some other people have found that are miles away from ground zero and appear to have been melted on the basis of some sort of resonance effect in the actual car itself. So that would indicate the presence of extreme microwave fields hovering around and bouncing around. So, you know, the problem is they've all got their problems. So I began to look at the problem of the murder weapon in a very different way. What if there were more than one player, deep player, involved? So you're dealing with kind of the Agatha Christie Murder on the Orient Express problem, because if you recall in that famous novel, everybody has a motive and the opportunity to commit the murder in the novel. And when the detective, Hercule Poirot, gathers everybody together, he points out that you're all guilty because one person murders the individual in a certain way and then leaves, and then another person comes in and murders the corpse again to make sure it's good and dead and uses an entirely different method of killing the corpse. So on and on we go. And that's what I think happened on 9/11, more or less. And we can get into some deeper arguments as to why I think there is the presence of this third level serving notice to the second level. Oh, by the way, we're here and looky, looky what we can do.
Hmm. Wow. Okay. So now you have level one, level two, level three. How would you define? Level one are the actual hijackers.
The patsies,
and there's some anomalies with them, which suggest, of course, each level suggests a further level.
Yes, exactly.
Which suggests, of course, a level two.
Right.
Okay. So want to handle level one and level two? Kind of explain that for our audience and why, how that undermines the official narrative.
Well, level one, you know, the fact is that at level one, you have the presence of a number of Saudis, and then the FBI fingers a bunch of these people. And then, oh, by the way, some of them that are supposed to have died turn up alive and actually walk into FBI offices and say, hey, I didn't participate in this. Here I am. I'm alive and well. So right at the outset at level one, you have the problem of, number one, Saudi involvement at some level. And this cannot happen. In my estimation, given all of the close ties between the American deep state and the financial community and the Saudi government, without the knowledge of that deep state. So we have to start looking at these people. But when you turn to the deep state itself, again, I think you're dealing with essentially a kind of neocon rogue element And again, I think the 9/11 truth community here was spot on when they pointed out the Project for a New American Century and its publication prior to 9/11, that we need a new kind of Pearl Harbor event in order to project American power into Central Asia and the Middle East and secure all these energy resources. And President Bush signaled that when he started referring to 9/11 as a new Pearl Harbor. In other words, yeah, I've heard your message, I get the message, and here we go. So I do think that there was this deeper rogue element within the American national security structure. And this is buttressed by something that Dr. Webster Tarpley started uncovering in his research. And, you know, again, hats off and kudos to him for doing all of this work. There were a massive number of drills on 9/11. That were mirroring, this is the key element here, that were mirroring aspects of the 9/11 operation itself. In other words, you had hijacking drills being conducted not only in the country but in that area. You had security stripping. You had lots of American fighter jets that were removed from the theater to take part in drills either in the Middle East or up in Alaska and so on and so forth. So in other words, when you've got security stripping like that, just like you have with JFK, you've got an inside job to be able to plan that operation as exact mirrors of what actually happened. Indicates that you've got a rogue element within the national security structure of the United States. And to top it all off, perhaps the scariest thing was that on 9/11, there was an operation, a drill, involving all of America's thermonuclear forces that were on alert and playing this big, huge war game on 9/11. And that's a key element here to the way I think we have to look for a possible third element here. It's kind of context for me for the Whopper doozy that I found squatting right in the middle of, in the middle of all of this. And I think you know what I mean concerning Muhammad Atta. But for me, going back to my reaction on 9/11, we had something very peculiar happen, and this was another factor that, in my mind, convinced me that we're watching a bit of very, very dark, very brutal theater. And that was President Bush's behavior that day. And many people have pointed this out. He's at Booker Elementary School. He's reading My Pet Goat. And so the official line goes, Andrew Card comes in, leans down, whispers into his ear, America's under attack. And then he sits there and finishes reading the book. Ari Fleischer holds up a sign, don't say anything yet. And then he holds a press conference. And now stop and consider this. America's under attack. Everybody knows the president is at a photo op and could therefore be a potential target. And yet he takes the time to have a press conference and announce the fact that America is under attack. And then he says, I will be flying immediately back to Washington, D.C. Then the motorcade leaves the school, goes back to the Sarasota airport to Air Force One. And then suddenly the whole situation changes. Air Force One flies out of Sarasota Airport, makes a huge power climb, yeah, you know, yeah, and does so without fighter escort. Yeah. And instead of going back to Washington, D.C., President Bush ends up landing at Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. And that was the first red flag to me, because most people don't know that Barksdale is the backup command facility for all of America's nuclear and thermonuclear forces. Okay? Once he gets to Barksdale, he jettisons the press corps, and then he gives another statement. And I was thinking the same thing when I was listening to this as a French researcher, Thierry Maison. Bush addresses the country again, and then in his address refers to attacks and that America is undergoing a test. But he never mentions the terrorist narrative in that second statement. And to me at the time, I thought, gee, that's very suspicious. Why not reinforce that terrorist message? Why are you now saying it's some sort of test? And if it's a test, who's the proctor of the exam? From Barksdale, he then flies on to Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska, which is, of course, the headquarters for all of America's nuclear and thermonuclear forces. So why fly to the two headquarters, the backup headquarter and then the actual headquarters? And at the time, I thought this was strange. Of course, at the time, we knew nothing about the fact that there was this big nuclear drill going on. But at this juncture, Webster Tarpley uncovered something else, and this actually did make the mainstream news, because you'll recall that sometime between when President Bush left Booker Elementary School and then got on Air Force One, at some point during that period, the White House switchboard was called, and whoever called the White House switchboard said, Air Force One, Angel is next, and proved, this is the key point, proved their bona fides by revealing a number of top secret codes from across the American command structure. In other words, codes from the FBI, the DEA, the National Reconnaissance Office, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the CIA, and on this list went. So, in other words, someone had revealed the possibility that they might have had the codes to launch America's thermonuclear weapons, and that a coup was underway, and that in order to prevent that coup, and I think Dr. Tarpley's dead on here, President Bush had to scramble to those two headquarters and reassert personal presidential authority over the command structure. Okay, I think that's exactly what went on. And let us recall that at the same time that this is going on, supposedly Vice President Cheney is rounded up by the Secret Service and scuttled out of his office down into the White House Situation Room. And, you know, there's two ways you can look at that. Number one, they're trying to protect him. Or number two, they're kind of placing him under house arrest, kind of an in-house coup. So that's the context behind which I started entertaining the idea, well, we're dealing with a penetrated operation here. Now, if you want, we can get into the actual level three people and why I think there's a level three involved here in 9/11, because that's the part of the story that really made the hair on the back of my neck raise straight up.
Well, level three's identity might be revealed in the story of Muhammad Atta, as your book right. shows, his connection to this rather strange organization, the Carl Duisberg Foundation or yeah. Society.
Yeah.
And this gets into your work regarding the Nazi International and this post-war right. setup. So would you want to maybe explain that for our audience, what that was, you know, Martin Bormann, 1944, the year?
Well, yeah. What I mean by Nazi International, and, you know, people think I'm nuts for mentioning Nazis in connection with all this, but folks, you got to read my books and look at the footnotes and documentation in them. I document my books rather thoroughly. In August of 1944, Martin Bormann and the Nazi hierarchy began an organized flight capital strategic evacuation program.
Now, this was because by that time, the breakout out of Normandy had occurred, and it was pretty, right. pretty clear that the Third Reich was going to suffer a military defeat.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah. The Allied military effort compared to the Soviet Union's was really not even in the same category. Germany was going to lose the war to the Soviet Union. This was the handwriting on the wall mm-hmm. after Stalingrad. The breakout in Normandy simply, you know, adds fuel to the fire. But this was a decision that the Nazi hierarchy, I think, really began to take after the Stalingrad disaster, when it became clear that Germany could not win the war. It might be capable of stalemating it, but not win it.
So that was January 1943.
That was January of 1943, okay. correct. Bormann began a flight capital program to take all of this Nazi loot and move it out of Nazi Germany and into foreign countries through bank accounts in the Bank of International Settlement, other banks in Switzerland, and so on, and to set up massive amounts of front companies around the world in conjunction with Nazi Party liaison officers. And the express purpose of this was to use that capital for the rebuilding of Europe and, incidentally, the creation of a European federation, which Germany would be able to dominate. Gee golly. You know? And incidentally, folks, if you think I'm making that up, read my book called The Third Way, because I go into great detail about how the structure of the modern European Union mirrors almost exactly plans for precisely such a thing that were drawn up during World War II and sponsored by the Reichsbank and IG Farben. Okay, so in other words, Bormann set up an international kind of extraterritorial state with its own command structure, with deep, deep financial pockets, and with deep connections to the post-war international multinational corporate world, including some major American and Western banks, major companies, you know, Siemens and so on and so forth. You can think of all these big German companies. So in other words, this organization was not just Klaus Barbie or Adolf Eichmann or whoever hiding out in grass skirts and grass huts in the middle of the Amazon basin. This was much, much more substantial. And in addition to this, I firmly believe, and I present a certain amount of evidence in my book, The Nazi International, that this organization continued some of its top secret scientific research after the war in host countries like Argentina. So in other words, you're dealing with kind of a real life version of Spectre from the James Bond films. I call it the fascist mafia, because clearly they crawled into bed with the international criminal underworld. And then of course you've also got all of the ties between wartime Nazi intelligence and the post-war American CIA. You've got all those paperclip scientists mm-hmm. coming over here. So in other words, this was not an ad hoc effort. All of these things were very, very carefully planned by the Nazis prior to the end of the war. Now, why is all of this important? Well, if you're dealing with an international organization like that with deep financial pockets, then effectively you're dealing with a very, very different world than that which is presented on the mainstream media. For example, for years I've thought that 9/11 and the so-called war on terror might really have been about a war against that organization, because in my research in that book, what I uncovered was something, Tim, that I can't describe my reaction other than one of both shock and disbelief and yet confirmation of my whole thesis. Because Mohammed Atta, most people don't know this, that soporific, evil-looking man whose picture we've seen, you know, ever since 9/11, posted on television screens and in magazine articles, that man was recruited in Saudi Arabia, in Cairo, and this was uncovered by a researcher by the name of Daniel Hopsicker, another 9/11 truth researcher, a journalist. He was recruited in Cairo by two Germans whose names we've never been able to find out. And they bring him to Germany, where, of course, we know from the official narrative, he lives for a number of years in a middle-class region, in a middle-class house in Hamburg, Germany, with this couple. And I thought, well, gee, there's a German connection here. Why is that squatting right in the middle of 9/11 with the supposed ringleader of these hijackers? And then I read something in Hopsicker's book that floored me, because his sponsor there in Germany was an organization, a foundation called the Karl Duisberg Gesellschaft. And when I read that, my suspicion meter went right into the red zone, because if you don't know who Carl Duisberg was, he was the CEO of the big German chemicals firm Bayer during World War I. And if you don't think Bayer is big, just recall that it recently had enough cash on hand to buy out Monsanto. Okay, it's a huge chemicals company. But what people have to understand is that Duisberg and Bayer were founding elements of the interwar conglomerate IG Farben. And when you say IG Farben, you're really saying Nazi war machine. It would be like saying Lockheed Martin and Boeing all in one breath, all in one big corporation. Mm-hmm. This corporation, Tim, was so gigantic and so powerful, people don't realize that that corporation didn't stop existing when World War II ended. It was only finally liquidated in 2003.
Really? Wow.
Yes. Yeah. 2003. It had so many licensing agreements and patent swap agreements with so many corporations all around the world. It took that long to sort through it all. It was an extraordinarily powerful corporation. And, of course, it was a huge technological and financial backer to Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. So when I found Carl Duisberg Society sponsoring Mohammed Atta, the red flags went up, because this precisely moves it out of the region of standard terrorist attacks by pissed off Muslims against the great Satan. This moves it into a whole different realm. So when you turn to Mohammed Atta at the Venice Flight School in Florida, and again, this is all brought out in Hopsicker's book. It's an excellent book. It's called Welcome to Terrorland, if you want to go out and read it. His principal visitors when Atta was in Venice, Florida, at this flight school, were not Arabs. They were not Saudis. They were people with names like Peter and Hans and Jürgen and Wolfgang, who would come over from Europe and visit this guy with piles of money. And Atta himself, of course, by that time knew fluent German. He spoke French. He even spoke Hebrew, you know. So in other words, this guy doesn't look like your typical radical Muslim. This guy looks more like an intel agent from somebody. Now, what really got me here, Tim, was two things that were said by Prime Minister Tony Blair after 9/11, and then something that was said by a Russian economist before 9/11. Tony Blair after 9/11 said Al-Qaeda was really nothing but a kind of code for something connected to, in his words now, a global network, okay? But he never specifies what that network was. But he's telling you right there that you're not dealing with a state actor in the typical sense. So in other words, right there he's telling you that there is a level three beyond any rogue element within the American deep state. But what really got me, Tim, was this I remember hearing very early on after 9/11 on a few mainstream media reports, and then it was just suddenly dropped. But fortunately, you know, the ever alert Jim Myers picked up on this. And it's very interesting that prior to 9/11, in Russia, a Russian economist by the name of Dr. Tatiana Koryagina wrote an article in Pravda in Russia. And she stated that America would soon undergo terrorist attacks on significant targets on its own soil. And that, here's the clincher, these attacks would come from a small network of very powerful men, a global network, with assets in excess of $300 trillion, and that they were doing all of this to remake the world according to their own designs. There's level three. And if you look at that and then connect the dots back to World War II, to this post-war Nazi strategic evacuation plan that literally scattered itself around the globe, scattered massive amounts of money around the globe. $800 million, for example, in 1945 dollars, in accounts controlled by Juan and Evita Perón, just in Argentina. That's in 1945 dollars. That's an enormous chunk of money. And this is being spread all over the globe. So in other words, it looks to me, you know, connecting the end of World War II and 9/11, that you're dealing more or less with the same entity, with deep, deep connections to the Western deep state, to the financial elites in the West, because after all, they're meeting at Bilderberg meetings with each other. Hitler's paymaster, his banker, is an early attendee at these early Bilderberger meetings for a purpose. So it looks to me, Tim, as if in a certain sense on 9/11 divorce papers were served on that old post-war alliance between the West and its oligarchy and this deep state fascist mafia, for want of a better expression. Now, believe it or not, all of that is not the most sensational connection that I uncovered looking into all of this.
Well, first of all, the Carl Duisberg Society established, I think, in 1949.
Yeah, it was established in 1949.
What is its function?
Well, on the surface, its function is to sponsor, good feelings, good relationships, poor students, and multiculturalism, and all this wonderful stuff.
Okay, sounds like some sort of like spying intel operation or something.
Exactly. Precisely. This is a nice front for the old IG Farben corporate spy network. That's really all I think it is.
Yeah.
You know, why else would Bill and Hillary Clinton and Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski and Helmut Schmidt and all these people be sponsors of that society?
Well, or more like the Rhodes Scholarship, right? Where it's
it's kind of like the same thing there.
Yeah, similar thing.
Yeah, it's a cutout. It's a front.
And this may be an invidious comparison, but I think it might be spill out the viability of your theory regarding the Nazi International is that you don't need a state to be powerful, influential. A good example would be perhaps the Zionist influence prior to the establishment of Israel. Well, it was the sort of transnational financial empire, right?
Yeah, it's the same sort of thing here.
Yeah,
exactly.
Same thing.
You know, it's not just the Zionists doing this. It could be anybody.
You've got
enough money and connection. Okay. So, yeah, you're looking at something like this. But the real key for me that there is a profound fascist international involvement with all of this is a Swiss banker by the name of François Genoud. All right. François Genoud was the banker of accounts after World War II, handling all of those Nazi accounts for this post-war Nazi network in Swiss banks after the war. He was a bankroller of Otto Skorzeny's International Terrorism Conference in Barcelona, Spain, in the late 60s and 70s, all right? And Otto Skorzeny, if you don't know, was Hitler's favorite SS commando that retired to a very cushy existence in nationalist Spain after the war, hosting these terrorism conferences with people like Yasser Arafat, you know, people like this in attendance.
Yeah, this is isn't he also one that plucked Mussolini from his captors?
Oh, sure, yeah. He was the guy that rescued Benito Mussolini. But before I get into François Genoud, it's important for people also to remember that prior to and during World War II, the Nazi Party made deep, deep inroads and connections with the radical Muslim groups, particularly with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt under Bana, particularly with the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, al-Husseini. You can actually go online and see pictures of Adolf Hitler talking to al-Husseini during the war. Husseini helped raise Muslim divisions for the Waffen-SS to fight on the Eastern Front against the godless Slavs, you know. But anyway, these connections between Nazism and radical Islam are there for all to see if you want to dig long enough. And that's where the bankrolling is coming from. It's not just from the Saudis. It's from this international fascist network. So, you know, in a certain sense, I think the war on terror is kind of a cover for the fact that if that group did announce itself to level two on 9/11, it's interesting that the American response is to make a beeline for places that were Nazi havens during World War II, Afghanistan, Iraq, and so on and so forth. So there's something going on here behind the scenes. But getting back to François Jeannot, he was the banker for all of these Nazi accounts in Switzerland. He was the fundraiser for Otto Skorzeny and his international terrorist summits and so on and so forth. He helped establish the financial basis of this post-war Nazi international outfit. And here's the key clincher here. He was also the banker for the Bin Laden family.
Wow. And, yeah.
And he was also the guy that talked the Bin Laden family into making Deutsche Bank their bank of choice. So stop and consider this, folks. Now we have a prime mover and financial shaker of Nazi money and loot and this organization after World War II, all the way up to his death in the early 1990s. And he's also kind of the ex officio financial agent for the Bin Laden family.
And doesn't Deutsche Bank link directly to 9/11 through A.B.
Brown? Oh, yeah. Deutsche Bank links directly to 9/11 through A.B. Brown, Alex Brown, and in other ways, because Deutsche Bank was heavily involved, as was the German national airline Lufthansa, in all of those puts and shorts.
And who was the assistant or executive director of the CIA at the time?
Oh, golly, you've got me a Krongard, I think.
Yeah, Buzzy Krongard, who used to work for A.B. Brown, right?
Yeah, exactly. So you've got German, or rather, I should say, some sort of international fascist Deutsche Bank fingerprints all over this. And suspiciously, the other thing I bring out in the 9/11 book is not only the fact that Deutsche Bank's computers, as the Twin Towers were actually being struck, Deutsche Bank's computers were taken over for about 7 seconds, according to some of their employees. They didn't know where this came from, and a bunch of stuff was downloaded during the actual attacks on the Twin Towers. But even more interesting, oh boy, I forgot what I was going to say.
Was it Alan Dulles?
No. It was something else the German fingerprints all over 9/11.
Okay.
The other interesting thing that I found was that it was a German firm that had been hired to go in and remove all the hard drives from the computers that were still remaining after the collapse of the World Trade Center.
That's right, Convar, right?
Yeah, Convar, and to try and recover data. Now, why a German firm, folks? Don't we have the FBI laboratories that can do this? Yeah, we do. That's what the FBI is supposedly for. Don't we have American firms that can do this? Well, yeah, probably. So why do we have to hire a German firm to come in and do this? Again, there are huge pointers to some angle of German involvement in this that nobody wants to look at. And the other clincher for me here about level three and possible Saudi international global fascist mafia involvement, if you will, in all of this, is the fact that there were a few countries warning us in almost a way that conveys the impression that they were alarmed and trying to ring the alarm prior to 9/11. There were the Israelis, of course, warning us. Suspiciously, Saudi Arabia did not. But virtually everybody else did. Egypt tried warning us. Jordan tried warning us. The Israelis tried warning us. The Russians gave us a warning. And guess who? The Germans. So somebody's trying to warn us that there's something that's going to come down. And again, this is ignored. And I think the only way that you can get that kind of ignorance is that you have people on the inside working it to at least ensure that the attacks happen, to pull off their agenda. And then voila, the Twin Towers come down when they don't really need to, and they come down in such a way as to indicate that whoever brought them down, you're dealing with another player, because they have some pretty sophisticated technology at their disposal, and they know how to do it. This is why I think the question of how the Twin Towers came down and those four hypotheses is an indicator that you're dealing with different players.
And the second level conspirators would have gotten the message as those towers came down.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Now, exactly. One thing you want to mention is François Giraud is I read also you said that he also was the person who put Alan Dulles in contact with General Carl Wolf, SS.
Yes, that's correct.
In Switzerland to negotiate.
In Switzerland. Yes.
This sort of this post-war set, the paperclip, this sort of post-war
right.
marriage.
Yes,
as
exactly.
You call it.
Exactly.
And so this third level, Nazi international, is fascist international marriage with the post-war national security state. And, of course, this is the early days of the Cold War,
right.
Before the Cold War starts. Maybe it starts the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
It's the National Security Act of 1947 creates a central intelligence agency.
Right.
They bring in all these paperclip Nazis to form the Soviet desk. That's the Galen Network. That was
right.
The, and you also have them going into NASA.
Right.
Who knows where else? This few years later, you have Bilderberg,
mm-hmm.
right? And so you have this Dulles Wall Street pro-Nazi, or for lack of a better term, faction setting up this post-war era to fight the communist.
Right.
And so this is this marriage, this sort of this, I guess you could call it this marriage of convenience that's formed in the 50s.
Right.
And what you're saying is on 2001, December 11th, there was a breach or something within this faction, and
right.
that third level event was the notice that, hey, you either pay up or do something, right?
Right. Yeah, I think there was a divorce. I do think that some sort of divorce papers were served on 9/11. Now, for what reason and why, I don't know. There's every indication of high financial skullduggery beyond just the puts and shorts that are going on 9/11. And we only have to look at the fact that the Pentagon was conducting some sort of investigation, the Office of Naval Intelligence, as a matter of fact, that was conducting some sort of financial investigation into some very, very high financial crimes involving about $240 billion worth of fraudulent securities that were set to clear that week. And wonder of wonders, on 9/11, the Securities and Exchange Commission suspended normal securities clearing regulations. And under normal regulations, you cannot substitute one set of securities for another in clearing. But when they suspended the regulation, when they suspended the regulations, of course, that rule went out the window. So those fraudulent securities may have been taken completely off the books and destroyed, and something else substituted in its place. So there is evidence of some sort of financial skullduggery going on way beyond just the puts and shorts that were placed on the stock markets.
Wasn't that linked to the economic rape of Russia in the 90s?
Yes, yes. That's the story. And, you know, that's why this is a very, very big story, because, of course, we had the Russian warning about all of this prior to that. We had, of course, the rise of Vladimir Putin inside of Russia that took out basically the financial oligarchs. And when you read into that story, you find all sorts of connections, detailed connections with the Western financial elite, and in particular with Harvard University and the Harvard Endowment. So there's all sorts of connections here that are lying in the background of 9/11. But to kind of give you my usual apt summary of what I think may have happened, we did strike some sort of deal with the fascist devil at the end of World War II with all of these Nazis. And ultimately that meant we were striking a deal with Martin Bormann. I don't think that hideous man died in Berlin. You know, there's every indication from Argentine sources that he was alive and well and in control of this post-war outfit for some time after World War II.
Isn't there a canceled check drawn to Chase Bank or something with his name
on it? Yes, there was. Yeah, this was something that was uncovered by Paul Manning. He was an old CBS reporter and journalist, a close personal friend with Ed Murrow, you know, the sort of pre-Walter Cronkite, Walter Cronkite. And Manning investigated Martin Bormann's survival after the war in South America. And he writes in his book that he discovered that a check for a couple of million dollars had been cleared by had been drawn on accounts at Manufacturers Hanover and Chase Manhattan Bank, and then cleared through Deutsche Bank in Buenos Aires, and the check was signed with Martin Bormann's own signature. You know, what does that tell you about our banking system, folks? You know, and I make the joke that, you know, if you're making deals with this Nazi devil at the end of World War II, when you're dealing with Martin Bormann, you're dealing with Dick Cheney without the warmth and charm. You know, you're dealing with a real Don Corleone here, and not only that, he's got the intelligence network and knows where you live, Mr. Rockefeller. And
yeah, it also shows he also has the Israelis on a short leash too.
Yeah, this guy's in bed with everybody, the Israelis, the Saudis, you name it. Yeah. And you know, this is a pattern that shows up again with this Nazi banker, François Genoud. So, you know, it becomes pretty clear to me that there's an avenue of investigation with the 9/11 story that even the 9/11 truth community has either not been aware of or has not followed up, or perhaps deliberately not followed up. You know, it's a huge sinkhole of a story, and it demands that you connect so many dots. I suspect that that's the reason why.
Well, I think the pitfall when you're looking at these things is you reach a certain level and the explanation is adequate, and it maybe it confirms, you get confirmation bias perhaps.
Well, yeah. It's a confirmation bias. I think you're correct there. Yeah. But I think the other thing is that many of these researchers, you know, Mr. Hofsecker, the man that wrote Murder in Terrorland or something, or Welcome to Terrorland, I'm sorry. I don't think that he may have known really about what the significance of Mohammed Atta being connected to a society named for one of the founders of IG Farben really was.
Yeah, he's just pointing out the fact that the connections are there and this is weird.
Yeah, this is weird and we don't need to go any further. But when you dig further, you know, you uncover this huge rabbit hole and you're thinking – you've got to be thinking, any normal person would, that when you're looking at all this, you're thinking, Nazis? You
know? Yeah. It's like a bad movie. Yeah.
It's like a bad Hollywood B movie. Yeah. Yeah, precisely.
It's like a Nazi base in some island somewhere that you undercover.
Right. I mean, it sounds so ridiculous until you actually see the documentation for it is really there. That's when it becomes very serious.
Well, that, and also you realize a lot of these bad movies or novels, like the Bond novels, are based on reality.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and you know, that's always the disconcerting thing about all of this. You know, we're watching something play out here, I think, Tim, that's very interesting. And if we suspend our normal reactions and disbelief for a moment, let's look at the Ukraine here for a moment. When this country, and I have no bones about saying, when this country overturned a legitimately elected government in the Ukraine, and I'm old-fashioned, in English it's the Ukraine, not simply Ukraine, folks. When we did that, we brought into power in Kiev a group of people that had deep connections to the World War II Ukrainian fascist movements, all right? So Moscow is entirely correct here when they've been pointing this out. But here's the thing that really got me. There's a Russian economics advisor that's very close to President Putin by the name of Sergei Glazyev. And he wrote an op-ed piece about 2 years ago during the kind of the height of the Ukrainian crisis. He wrote an op-ed piece about 2 years ago in which he said, and I'm quoting as close as my memory will allow me here, that our problem isn't the Nazis in Kiev. Our problem is the Nazis in Washington, unquote. And he meant it. You read mm-hmm. that statement in the context that he's writing, and he's not resorting to rhetorical hyperbole or mere rhetoric to make a point. No, he means what he says.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, put that in context of Tatiana Koryagina's statement, Prime Minister Tony Blair's statement, and there's something about 9/11 that looks very, very different than the standard narrative and war on terror and rogue elements in the American deep state. You're looking at something very, very different. And that's why I think, you know, it's important to mention all this. People have to start looking at this in a very deep way. I mean, mm-hmm. we've just, to give you a little teaser here, we've just been through not an election in this country, but I think really a referendum. And it's interesting that that referendum's results were called on 11/9, which is kind of a reversal of 9/11.
Yeah.
So we've been living for, you know, about 30 years under the aegis of this globalist neocon Bush Clinton faction cabal. And, you know, you don't need to dig or scratch very long to find connections between the Bushes and the Nazis.
That's what's so strange about this, to wrap your head around this, because you have this neoconservative, which is largely Jewish.
Right.
In bed, apparently, you know, with – because there's always been a sort of a symbiotic relationship between Zionism and National Socialism. Obviously, yeah, they rely on one another.
Yeah, it's very strange because most people don't want to go there. But in point of fact, that relationship is there. There's a wonderful book out by a fellow by the name of Christopher Simpson called Blowback. And if you don't believe me in terms of this relationship between the interwar Zionists and the Nazis, he points it out very clearly. There was a Zionist kind of guerrilla leader. We would call him a terrorist now. Back then they were guerrillas, by the name of Fievel Polkus, that was leading a Zionist insurrection movement in Palestine called Haganah. Think of it as kind of the Zionist equivalent of Hezbollah or Hamas mm-hmm. or something like this. And, you know, committing acts of terror against Christians and Muslims and even other Jews in the area, you know, well, just to drive the agenda.
Yeah.
And Fievel Polkus was trained by the SS at special training camps in Germany. and the guy that approves all of this is none other than Reinhard Heydrich.
You know? Yes.
A real beast of a man. You know, this Zionist-Nazi connection is so deep and pervasive, and most people don't even really – and please don't get me wrong. I'm not saying the state of Israel is in bed with Nazis or anything like that. Because one of the most famous instances that exposed that whole relationship was a trial that took place in Israel in 1955 between a doctor, a Zionist doctor, by the name of Rudolf Kastner, K-A-S-T-N-E-R, that was recognized by a little elderly Jewish lady as having been one of the collaborators with Adolf Eichmann, helping to round up his own people and ship them off to Auschwitz. This was a huge trial in Israel. It was written up by the famous Jewish playwright Ben Hecht in this country in a book called Perfidy. You know, Ben Hecht was well known. He wrote screenplays for Rod Serling and Twilight mm-hmm. Zone and so on and so forth. So, you know, you're not dealing with some sort of nutcase guy, you know, that just coming along and wants to put out a crazy conspiracy theory. No, this, you know, this was a Jewish man, and he was very concerned about, you know, what this trial was really implying.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is a very strange relationship. Most people can't wrap their heads around it, but yeah, it's there. You've got this Nazi organization with its fingers into just about every pie you can think of.
Well, yeah. Well, the, like you said, one of the Zionists, objective, of course, was the establishment of the Israeli state.
Israeli state, right.
And to get that, they needed a crisis.
Yeah, this was precisely, and this is what Hecht brings out in his book, was this was precisely the reasoning behind Costner and his involvement helping round up his own people. And you know, stop and think of another famous name that did exactly the same thing. It's still scot-free. That was bankrolling the Clinton campaign. So, you know, these people are birds of a feather. They think they're above the law. They think they're above, you know, everybody else. I don't care what you are, Muslim, Christian, or Jew, or atheist, or whatever. You know, these people think they're above the law because they're plugged into this big, huge network of a global fascist mafia.
Mm-hmm. And he's busy destabilizing Europe and the United
States. Yeah, exactly.
I think I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, he's whether it's Black Lives Matter or, I think even some of the white nationalist movements.
Well, he's the Emperor Palpatine of the age. He's the dark Sith Lord of the age. Creating chaos and crisis just to further his own personal power and wealth, but you know it's a telling thing once you realize that there are these global groups, deep extraterritorial states, all of their own, that you're not dealing so much with radical Muslims. I mean, let's face it, folks. These people are incapable of building a rifle, not to mention a tank or a rocket or a bomb. They have to have major financial support from somewhere able to get them their arms and so on and so forth. So you're really dealing not only with radical Islam, you're dealing with a weaponized religion, essentially, and somebody else has their hands on the trigger. And as far as I'm concerned, the historical connections of this post-war fascist mafia to that kind of Islam is there for all to see if you just bother to look.
Now, and one point you make out is that this organization, we tend to think of the world in terms of nation states, governments,
right.
Politicians, and
corporations.
Now we're dealing with sort of this transnational corporate setup.
Well, but in calling it a mafia, I want people to think in terms of something much deeper lying behind corporations. You know, and don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that transnational, multinational corporations are not a danger to our God-given rights and freedoms. Because they are. You won't find the Bill of Rights in any corporate charter, and quite frankly, I think they need to be.
Mm-hmm.
But the real problem is when you – and the reason I use the term mafia is you're dealing with something that lives behind corporations and that relies on personal networks of trust and uses corporations themselves as fronts. I mean, the CIA does this all the time, so mm-hmm. It shouldn't surprise us that you can have other types of organizations doing exactly the same thing, penetrating institutions in key positions and using them for their own benefit. And in calling it a mafia, I have another objective in mind, and that is I don't want people to be thinking I'm trying to advance some sort of grand unified conspiracy theory where, you know, the Masons are behind it all, or the Zionists, or the Jesuits, or the international bankers, or the Nazis, or so on. Because it is a mafia. Everybody has a seat at the table, and they can sit there and sip their brandies and smoke their cigars and kiss each other's rings and plot world domination, while at the same time out on the street they're shooting at each other because they all want to be the faction in control at the end game. So in other words, I'm not trying to advance a big grand conspiracy theory here. I'm only concerned with what I see in the evidence surrounding the 9/11 events themselves and what they might imply.
Yes, the world is run by a criminal syndicate with various factions. And I think you referenced it in some of your interviews, if not in your book, I don't recall, but basically it's the scene out of The Godfather.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, where they're meeting at the table and The Godfather reveals so much how the world really works. If you see that movie or, you know, read the book, or more people have seen the movie, But right. Yeah, and that's how it functions. And you have various factions, whether it's the Atlanticists, Anglo-American, Zio faction. Now, what you reveal is this third level in 9/11 would be this Nazi faction, which was attached largely to the Anglo-American faction because of the Cold War. But the Cold War ends, right?
Right.
That so then we have 9/11. So that might explain why it went down when it did.
Yeah. The operating parameters of this group of people after World War II was precisely to stir up as much tension between the East and West as possible, because strategically that gave them, and more particularly Germany, maneuvering room. So it's very interesting to watch American moves on the diplomatic chessboard in recent years with that backdrop in mind, because it's been the old geopolitical maxim, you know, beginning with the British Empire in the 19th century, that above all, you must prevent a Russo-German rapprochement, because you're dealing there with two enormous powers. You know, Germany doesn't seem to be, to most people, to be a power, but for crying out loud, Germany has basically the fifth or fourth largest economy in the world, depending on which list you consult, on a population base of about 80 million people. So in other words, per capita, this is just a titanic economic powerhouse. And as we know all too well from history, as a matter of fact, you can take that little powerhouse economy and turn it into a pretty sophisticated military in a very short time. And Russia, as we know, is a power simply by dint of the fact that not only is it a major technological power, a major industrial power, but it's a power simply by the sheer landmass that it occupies.
Yeah, it's placed on the
and
map. Yeah,
yeah, it has genuine strategic depth that few countries in the world can claim. So you must prevent that rapprochement at all costs. Well, what do you see the United States doing? Interestingly enough, it's positioning bases now in Eastern Europe, precisely between Russia and Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason here is that behind the scenes, this is what they really want to prevent. And as long as they can do that, they can keep that German dominance of Europe, or so they think, more or less in check. I don't think that's going to last, quite frankly.
NATO was keep Germany down and Russia out.
Yeah, you know, Zbigniew Brzezinski, in his book The Grand Chessboard, Tim, writes something very interesting, that NATO was as much about how to deal with the vexing problem of power politics in the 20th century, and he comes right out and says, and that is how to deal with German power. You know, that those are his words, not mine.
Yeah, one thing that's interesting, if you look at the broader historical view of all this, is German power. I think you can make the argument that was a blowback, because German power developed out of the Napoleonic Wars, which was the French Revolution, which was a British Freemasonic project.
Well, yeah, you raise a very good historical point here. Yeah. Bonaparte really was responsible for the eventual rise of a unified Germany. In other words, he just kind of threw Cardinal Richelieu's warning about, you know, France should never allow a unified Germany, because if it does, France will no longer be the dominant power of Europe. And Bonaparte, you know, when he invades Prussia and Austria during those various wars from 1803 up to 1807, he unifies several of the small German states in the Rhineland area, Rhineland-Westphalen. He abolishes the old Holy Roman Empire, which, you know, was kind of the paper entity on paper that needed to get rid of in international law. And then he consolidates several other German states. And what this effectively does, of course, is after the Napoleonic Wars, when Prussia is reestablished as a major power in Central Europe, it makes it very, very easy for Prussia to unify Germany eventually, which of course it does.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're absolutely correct. Bonaparte has a huge role, and like you, I suspect not so much a British Masonic plot, but I do think that there's definitely a Masonic angle lurking in the background of Bonaparte, because you only have to look at Maurice de Talleyrand, to get a clear picture that this guy is one long. I mean, we're dealing with the foreign minister under Louis the 16th, with the foreign minister of France under the various revolutionary governments. He survives that to become foreign minister under the Directory. Then he becomes foreign minister under Napoleon. And then he becomes foreign minister of France once again under the Bourbon Restoration under Louis the 18th. And, so he does have these Masonic connections, and you've got Bonaparte's expedition to Egypt, which I think was a clear Masonic inspired expedition, and Talleyrand is right in the thick of that one too. Mm-hmm. So you've got all of these bizarre connections, but Napoleon, I'm in agreement with you. There's a Masonic aspect to his regime that is little probed, and he does make possible the eventual unification of Germany under a single state in 1871. So, we're living with deep history, deep consequences of things that happened 200 years ago or so.
Yes, that's exactly. So, one thing with the 9/11 thing, you talk about. It was you referred to it as blackmail, the official.
Yes,
and it goes all up to the 2007, 2008 bailouts. Want to get into that?
Yeah, that's an aspect of things too here, Tim. I suspect I haven't really argued a solid prima facie case for this opinion, but I suspect that there's a deep connection between 9/11 and the 2008 bailouts because, and I'll be very blunt. I don't know about you, but when I was watching the bailout hearings take place, I was struck by the fact that Bernanke and some of these other bankers that were testifying before Congress were insisting over and over again that they could have they wanted no oversight mm-hmm. on what they were going to do with all this money. And I'm thinking, wait a minute here. You come in and expect us to bail out all these too big to fail, too big to jail banks, and then insist on no oversight. Now, to me, Tim, that sounds like someone who's the victim of a kidnapping and someone is demanding a ransom from them and they're trying to raise the money to pay off the ransom to the kidnapper. And, of course, the kidnapper says, and if you contact the police in any way, the deal's off. So it looked to me like the bailout hearings that somebody had some sort of gun to these bankers' heads. Otherwise, there would have been no need for them to say that. There's some sort of pressure, in other words, that they're under, that they cannot indicate what they intend to do with all that money. So that, to me, says we may be dealing with the same group or groups that were involved in a very, very deep way with 9/11, basically extorting a bunch of money from the American taxpayer and these institutions. I'm not placing the blame on Geithner or Bernanke or any of these people, because if that scenario is true, then they might have had to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The clue for me here, there's another clue in that, I've been advocating for many years that there's some sort of system of hidden finance in the world that the sheer volume of trade in it is so gigantic. And it's the reason why all of the financial predictions are wrong. It's not just the black budget. It's something much deeper.
Mm-hmm.
If you're only looking at 50% of the picture, then all of these gloom and doom prognostications, about the imminent collapse of the dollar tomorrow, buy gold today, that sort of thing. We've been, I'm old enough to remember, we've been hearing that since Richard Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
And these prognostications never come true. Well, if we get these bailouts, we're going to have hyperinflation. We're going to be like Rhodesia and Zimbabwe. And yet it hasn't happened. So that money's going somewhere. It's been put into a circuit. You put power in at one end of the circuit. You expect it to come out at the load end of the circuit, but yet it hasn't appeared at the load end of the circuit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going somewhere. And that's the problem. no conventional financial analysis really can account for this fact. Where has all that money gone?
And this traces back to post-war with the Yamashita's gold.
Yamashita, yes, exactly, it does. I covered that story. And at this stage, Tim, I should tell people that my books are all kind of interlocked. Reading the 9/11 book will take you back to other books that precede it that I've written, because they're all very, very deliberately interlocked. You can read them in any order you wish, but you'll discover that they're very carefully interlocked with each other. And part of that story has been this hidden finance system that I think has been put into place at the end of World War II, involving, as you mentioned, General Yamashita. He was a Japanese general. They called him the Tiger of Malaysia. He was an extremely capable tactician and operational commander. And he was placed in charge by the imperial government of the Philippines prior to the American invasion. And he was put into there for the express purpose of coordinating all of the vast amount of loot that the Japanese were quite literally suctioning out of Asia and Southeast Asia and China, and then transshipping it back to Japan. When the American submarine campaign became so dangerous to that effort, the Japanese decided to store a bunch of that loot at secret locations around the Philippine Islands, and General Yamashita was kind of put in charge of that. We tend to think of the Nazis, you know, scouring Europe and collecting all sorts of loot. But I can tell you without exaggeration that the Japanese effort kind of made the German effort look clumsy and inefficient because the Japanese were so incredibly thorough at the amount of loot of all kinds that they were sucking out of Asia and bringing back to Japan. A great deal of it in the form of bullion. And this is where the story gets very interesting, because that bullion, when the American authorities were made aware of it after World War II, through all of the previous estimates about the amount of bullion in the world, silver, gold, platinum, you name it, into a cocked hat, because there was so much of it. So that's led me to conclude that they kept this a state secret, and in fact, that's what Truman did. He insisted and authorized the recovery of as much of that loot as possible, but he made it top secret, so that in effect it became a hidden slush fund of money in the hands of the National Security Council after World War II, that quite literally put the American intelligence community in the banking business. And there's your hidden system of finance.
And that's a bad idea.
And that's a hugely bad idea. Yeah, because what it effectively did is you now have so much hidden money awash in the system that no one is taking account of. Vast amounts of wealth in the system, vast amounts of power, but they're all hidden.
No accountability. No
accountability whatsoever. No. And isn't it interesting that, of course, going back to the Bushes, that Prescott Bush was what? Well, he was in the banking business.
Mm-hmm.
And who ends up as director of the CIA eventually? Well, George Bush. You know, and incidentally, it was Nixon that brought him in.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got all of these banking connections, and then you've got this hidden slush fund. And let me be very clear, folks. You're dealing in billions of dollars back at that time, beginning with World War II, that by today could, due to interest and leverage and so on and so forth, and securities based on all of this stuff, could easily represent a huge hidden slush fund in the trillions of dollars. And once you've said that, then you have to ask the question, well, what was all of this for? And the standard answer is usually that, well, it was for funding covert operations against the communist bloc. But trillions of dollars far exceeds any monetary requirements of covert operations, no matter how big they might be. So what's the real use that this is going for? And my suspicion has always been that it has gone for the development of very exotic technologies that have been kept completely off the books, which brings us, of course, back to 9/11.
Yeah, yeah.
And the hypothesis that perhaps it was some sort of exotic energy weapon that may have brought the Twin Towers down. And that, incidentally, is my favorite hypothesis, wacky as it sounds.
And what can you, as Catherine Austin Fitz says, what could you do with unlimited money and unlimited manpower?
What
can you achieve at this?
You could achieve a lot, and besides that, you know, just the interest on a pool of money like that could fund and run a global government, mm-hmm. which of course has been their objective. You know, they've just been handed two rounding defeats lately. They're not going to give up, but I do think that the course now has to be toward a different sort of globalism, because this centralized model, if you look at the past 30 years, has been a colossal, stupendous failure.
Yeah, one thing I'm hoping – I don't want to get off track here. One thing I'm hoping is that perhaps the apparent rebellion within the national security state against Hillary Clinton was a representation of a faction within the ruling elite that are less insane and want some retrenchment and some normalcy.
I think that's exactly what you see going on. The retrenchment, I think, is represented in the fact that Trump wants to lower corporate tax rates and bring manufacturing back to this country. Well, Trump is a clever enough businessman to know that those corporations have trillions of dollars in their offshore accounts that they have not used,
mm-hmm.
because there's really no safe place for them to invest it. If you remake the business climate here, I think what you're going to see is all of that money beginning to hit, and beginning to hit in ways that are not going to be just used for financial capitalism, but for actual equity capitalism. In other words, for production.
Real production, yeah, yes.
Yeah, I think that's what, you know, looking at all of these dots that I've been trying to connect over the years, I think that's what you're looking at.
Yeah.
Because the centralization model hasn't worked and isn't working. So I think they're going to experiment now with a much more localized nation by nation sort of federalism.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in the long term, you know, time will tell if that's a correct hypothesis or not, but that's what I think we're looking at.
Now with 9/11, one of the most fascinating and disturbing parts of the book, I think, was near the end.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about, actually before I get into that, I want you bring in, of course, this penetration that mm-hmm. was probably enabled by the Promise software.
Yeah.
You want to get into Promise software a little bit, and then we'll move on to maybe the more occult aspects of 9/11, and we'll close out with maybe linking it to other events like the JFK assassination, how these all events are these deep state events all relate to one another.
Well, the Promise software, I'm sure most of your listeners are probably aware of what the Promise software was. This was software that was developed by the Inslaw Corporation during the Reagan administration, and the purpose of the software ostensibly was to be able to provide a software platform that could read the databases of the Department of Justice cases as they were working through the system. So they created a software that, in effect, could read any database in any computer language. In other words, this was an extraordinary, especially for that time, an extraordinarily powerful and sophisticated computer program. Now, the scandal began when the Department of Justice quite literally stole the software from William Hamilton and his corporation and began to adapt it secretly through the Wackenhut Corporation, allegedly, through the CIA, allegedly, and so on and so forth, with various back doors. And then the software was sold to foreign countries with those back doors in it. Which allowed the American intelligence community quite literally to access everybody else's, you know, secret intelligence through this software program. The problem is, in my opinion, those same back doors can work against you. And if you discover them, you can ride that same software system right into all of the nooks and crannies of the American government that started using it, including, you know, secret defense projects and so on. And in fact, I point out in the book that the case of the Chinese spy that was convicted of stealing secrets from Los Alamos actually did use the Promise software in that fashion, rode the back door in reverse. So I strongly suspect that when you had those phone calls to the White House switchboard during 9/11, revealing the presence of a group of people that had access to all these secret code names, that you were not, contrary to the hypothesis of Dr. Tarpley, dealing with moles in those organizations, which you certainly could have been, but that you might also be dealing with extremely expert cyber warriors that simply rode the program and uncovered all of those codes.
And they're able to make the threat against Air Force
One. To make the threat against Air Force One and so on and so forth, exactly.
And also maybe screw up the air traffic control monitoring too, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We had drills, as I said before, of hijacked airplanes, and those drills did include false radar blips on the air traffic control radars deliberately as a part of the drills. So imagine now if you have a hacking capability, you can add a few extra radar blips or take a few of the radar blips we added out. So in other words, we're seeing all this attention on cyber warfare right now. I think that in itself is blowback and fallout from this whole InSlaw Promise scandal. That's what I think is happening.
And with 9/11, I remember at the time there was a report that FBI agent Robert Hansen had sold Promise software to Russian mafia?
Yes, yes. There's a famous – I mentioned this case in the book. Prior to Reagan's election in this country and then President Mitterrand's election in France, which occurred just a few months afterward, the United States – was trying to, as I mentioned, get this software into as many people's hands as quietly as possible. Well, after Mitterrand's election in France, there was an astounding thing that happened. A Russian KGB colonel, Ipilatov, I think was his name, presented himself to the French and defected, offered himself to be a double agent inside the KGB. And this colonel was so highly placed that he had access to the KGB's technology shopping list. And the French ran this mole for several years. The French DST ran this mole, probably the biggest mole in espionage history, inside the KGB for a number of years. When Mitterrand and Reagan first met in Ottawa, Canada, Mitterrand asked for private time with President Reagan, and he shared that secret with President Reagan, that France was running a mole, and a big one, and had the KGB's entire technology shopping list. In other words, that list alone told both the French and the Americans what the technological vulnerabilities in the Soviet Union were. It gave us a very clear picture. But Reagan, in turn, decided that this was too good of an opportunity. We couldn't pass it up. So he turned that file over to one of his national security people, a fellow by the name of Gus Weiss, who decided that, you know, we're going to take advantage of this. We're going to give the Soviets exactly what they're shopping for. We're going to contrive a way for them to steal or buy some of these computer software products on the black market, which they did. And I suspect some of it was this Promise software or Promised Influence software with all these back doors in it that were sold to the Soviet Union. And as a result of that, they used that software at one point to blow up a Soviet natural gas pipeline. It was visible from outer space. It was a huge explosion. They used that software quite literally to start sabotaging the Russian infrastructure. So there's a lot of cyber warfare that has been going on back and forth between these two countries. As a result of that explosion, the Russians almost immediately set up an entire branch within their security structure to start studying cyber warfare, cyber defense, and so on and so forth. And they've become very, very good at it, as most people know. You've had strange events recently, that explosion of the power plant in Murmansk just a few days ago. I think this whole cyber war thing is gearing up in a major way. But I do think that there is a promise connection to it. Yes.
Now, would that suggest another level of intrigue to the Hansen spy case?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Are we to infer from that maybe he was a triple agent?
He could have been, absolutely. In the world of espionage, you're dealing with a hall of mirrors.
Yeah, I mean, he could be. Well, who knows? I just thought that was interesting. Of course, the way it was treated in the media was he sold it to some Russian mafia figures who gave it to Osama bin Laden.
Well, that could be too.
Yeah,
could easily be.
Who was a CIA asset? So.
Yeah, exactly.
So go figure.
No surprise there, you know. And it was sold to Jordan. It was sold to Egypt. It was sold to Iraq. It was sold to the United Kingdom and Germany. And interestingly enough, after 9/11, the United Kingdom and Germany began to overhaul their security services and remove all Promise software-infected products in their security services. So in other words, they themselves, there's an indicator right there that there's a Promise connection to 9/11 with those two nations deciding, oh, we've got a big problem. We need to get rid of that software. So they knew something, and that indicates that there's a Promise role in 9/11, and that's what I think it may have been.
And, of course, with the event itself, in the book, you get into some of the problems regarding the crash sites, the fact that there's a lack of wreckage at all the principal crash sites.
Yeah, a big problem.
What happened at the Pentagon is certainly strange. And
very.
But Flight 77, I think you get into, and that is particularly interesting because that's the one that allegedly slams into the Pentagon. But then you have
right.
You have eyewitness testimony, which is contradictory, correct?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time looking at that issue, Tim, because, Barbara Honegger has done a lot of research on the Pentagon plane or lack thereof. And one of the things that I decided to do was look at the eyewitness testimony. There's actually a good website out there on the internet. I referenced it in the book. I can't recall it right off the top of my head. We have a lot of eyewitness testimony that was just kind of gathered and put out there. And when you read it, it's very, very intriguing because some people, this occurred during rush hour on the morning of 9/11. And I've been to that part of D.C. I've driven down that freeway by the Pentagon. So, it's a very busy thoroughfare. And to me, having all those people there that were able to provide eyewitness testimony should have been an open and shut case. But quite the contrary, what you look at when you look at the eyewitness testimony is glaring contradictions. You have some eyewitnesses saying, yeah, I saw this big civilian airliner and it came right over my head, slammed into the Pentagon. Some of them see it doing cartwheels into the Pentagon. All sorts of stuff. And then some people say, no, I didn't see a big commercial jet airliner. I saw this little kind of turboprop job. That's kind of the impression you get from some of them. Some of them don't see a plane at all. They hear it and so on. But it sounds to me like, some of them are hearing and describing a missile, which has certainly been one of the theories out there in the 9/11 truth community. But you've got all these different eyewitness testimonies. But what really intrigued me, Tim, and I brought this point out in the book, is that a Boeing 757 or 67 or even a 737 that low flying over that thoroughfare, which is right by the Pentagon, and the people describing seeing it, in some cases flying right over them. The suspicious part about that is they do not describe with, I think, but one exception, the wash of the aircraft and the engines as it's going by them. There's no cars being flipped on the freeway. A jet engine, a jet aircraft taking off or landing is producing an enormous amount of thrust that can toss cars, as easily as a tornado can. Mm-hmm. This, you know, this is why you don't stand behind jet aircraft when you're taking off or landing. You know, this is common sense.
This is why they're able to take off.
Yeah, this is why they're able to take off, folks. Yeah, you know, yeah. Because they're putting a big plane up in the air.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's no one describing the wash from the aircraft. There's no descriptions. Yeah, and I saw in my rearview mirror all these cars being flipped over on the freeways. You know, there's none of that. And that makes me extremely suspicious of the official narrative right there, because a Boeing, particularly the later models, you know, the 757s and 767s, those big twin engine jet planes, they're going to produce a hugely significant wash. Those cars are going to be tossed around on that thoroughfare like Tinker Toys if the plane is flying as low as it is in the official narrative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a huge problem.
Yeah. And you also have the, of course, the famous Jamie McIntyre from CNN saying, I see no evidence the plane ever crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you're looking I was home watching the reports and looking at the Pentagon as they're saying, oh, and we now have reports that the plane struck the Pentagon. And I turned to my friend and I said, where's the debris?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't take a civilian aircraft that big, slam it into a building like that, and not see debris. And then, you know, the other thing that occurred to me as I was watching all of this is, if this is a terrorist attack, then why do you go through this torturous maneuver to try and slam into the side of the Pentagon? Why don't you just drop it right on the roof, and preferably not at that ring? You know, if you're going to attack the great Satan and the symbol of American power, why not drop it right on top of the part of the Pentagon that's the home of the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of Defense?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, even the way that it occurred is contradictory to the terrorist narrative that was being put out there on the day. So, you know, nothing about the Pentagon. And in fact, if you look at the way the 9/11 truth movement narrative really got its start, it was the Pentagon part of the story that first got the question marks raised. And then they started looking at the other issues of 9/11, the Twin Towers and Flight 93 and so on.
Yeah, WT, and also World Trade Center 7, which appears to be
World Trade Center 7, yes,
which appears to be one. I guess would be a second level event.
Well, yeah, I think you know, people,
that's controlled demolition. It
looks that like is clearly a controlled, clearly a conventional controlled demolition. Yeah,
yeah.
You know, and you have the famous case of the BBC reporter standing right in front of it, talking about Building 7. It appears has been deliberately destroyed, and you know, there it is standing right behind her.
20 minutes before Jane.
Yeah, 20 minutes before. Yeah,
and then the satellite feed cuts off.
Yeah, isn't that interesting how that works?
It's almost like you see the hook coming out the grabber, you know, from behind the stage.
Yeah, exactly. Don't go there yet. You know, don't go there. Don't go there, Lucy. You know, you'll have some splaining to do. So you know. The whole thing, you know, when you stop and look at it, it really is a shibboleth of just kooky sorts of explanations that, when you really examine it, don't make much sense.
But with the public traumatized, critical thinking is shut off.
And, exactly. You know, you create trauma to shut off the critical thinking faculty. This is what people really need to grab onto, is when you hear stories like this beginning to break on news, the first thing I would advise is turn off the volume.
Mm-hmm.
And get your thoughts collected. And be extremely critical. Even take notes if you have to.
Mm-hmm.
Turn the volume back on.
Yeah. Which brings me to the, I guess, how I want to close your interview out is, you get into sort of the cult angle of it.
Yes.
Of 9/11, and one thing I find interesting is that you see it as an anti-Masonic event, which would suggest, well, let's start with the occult level of it. So you point out some particularly disturbing. And one part which I hadn't even never thought about was the falling man. But then you draw that comparison, the hanging man, which I went wow when I saw that.
Yeah.
What that suggests. But go ahead. Let's talk about the occult
Well, I'm not the one bringing out the occult angle of it. I was reviewing a wonderful book out there by a fellow by the name of S.K. Bain called The Most Dangerous Book in the World. And, you know, I couldn't begin to do that book justice in that short chapter in the book. But I wanted people to be aware that his research is out there. He points out a number of things. And to be quite honest, I was suspicious about the occult angle of it myself. You know, I'd been to Manhattan, you know, several years previously and knew the World Trade Center area fairly well. And it did have the creepy feeling of a kind of occult temple right out in the open before your eyes if you just know what to look for. The Twin Towers themselves always represented to me the twin pillars of Yakin and Boaz from a Masonic Blue Lodge, because that's what you would see in a Masonic lodge is these two pillars. And that's what the Twin Towers represented. So by striking the Twin Towers, you're striking against a deep relationship between the high financial powers in the West and Freemasonry, which really has been there at least since, you know, the founding of the City of London, the Bank of England, and the Mother Lodge in Great Britain in the early 18th century. It's always been there. So striking those, you're striking not only the financial center, you're striking at a symbol of an alliance between a secret society in the West and its relationship to high finance. It's been more or less well known if you dig for it. And that in itself is to me yet another argument that you're looking at a third layer here, not a second layer. And that layer may have fascist connections because, of course, the Nazis were dead set against the Masons.
That's when I heard anti-Masonic. I thought, ooh, Nazi, yeah. Just because you're anti-Masonic doesn't mean you're a good guy.
Right, exactly. You know, so, and just because you're a Mason doesn't necessarily make you a bad guy.
Yeah.
You know, I know lots of Masons. That doesn't make me want to run out and join their lodges by any stretch of the imagination, because the historical record is clear that they have been up to skullduggery and bad things in their history.
I think with them it's literally a question of degree.
Yeah, it's quite literally. Yes, exactly. But Bain points out, since you mentioned the falling man, Bain points out in his book, there's a picture of someone
yeah.
that is jumping out of one of the twin towers as the fires are still burning inside and prior to their collapse. And this poor gentleman is hanging upside down, and he has his left leg extended straight and his right leg crossed in front of it like an inverted number 4.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now that to me, and I remember seeing that to me is so creepy because it resembles one of the major trumps in the tarot deck, the hanged mm-hmm. man. And what is the hanged man in the tarot deck? Well, the man is hanging upside down, suspended either between two trees or two pillars or doorposts or something. So there you have the twin towers. And he's hanging upside down in such a way that he's got one leg straight and the other leg crossed over the leg like a big inverted number 4. So the point here I'm trying to make is when you start examining all of the occult symbolism of 9/11, the numbers involved, the fact that you have the Pentagon strike. Well, what's the Pentagon? The Pentagon is another symbol of the pentagram. And what's the pentagram? Well, in some occult thinking, the pentagram is the symbol of the circle of protection. So not only are you striking the Pentagon, which is the source of American military command and therefore of protection, but you're striking a symbol of protection. And on and on, you know, on and on Bain's research goes. You really have to read his book to get the full dramatic effect of how detailed and numerous, and that's the key point here, numerous are all of these occult connections and symbols boldly on display during 9/11. you get to the point that you realize when you're reading his book that none of this can possibly be coincidental. This was planned down to the nth level, and it was planned by people with an intimate, detailed knowledge of occult ritual and practice. And therefore, you have to look at a certain circle of people that would be familiar with the details of Western esoteric lore and practice. So we can rule out as deep players at that level, the Saudis. We can rule out certain other types of, you know, the rogue element within the American intelligence complex. Some of them might have such knowledge, but certainly not all of them. So you're looking at a very, very deep player here to pull off a ritual like that.
And, of course, you've mentioned the date itself, 9/11.
Right, right. That is something that, if you stop and think about it, was the most clever part of the occult ritual, the most clever part of the traumatization and social engineering aspect of it. Because what were we trained for decades to call for emergencies? 9/11, 9/11, dial 9/11. So every time that you dial 911 right now, automatically, subconsciously, you're thinking of 9/11. It's like, don't think of the pink elephant in the room for the next 5 seconds. What you've done is you've planted something in the subconscious that is cognitive dissonance between your call for help or assistance, an emergency call, and the events of 9/11, which are the exact opposite. So that right there, that deep subliminal subconscious cognitive dissonance is a sign that you're dealing with practitioners of the high black arts, quite literally.
Exactly, and yeah, that's one part that really got me was because what that suggests, particularly with the falling man, is some level whether of stagecraft. Beyond the level I can understand, or perhaps some sort of, maybe fakery at some level.
You know? It might have been fakery. Who knows? Yeah. You know, you're dealing with people that are capable of almost anything because they have given up their God-given moral compass and conscience. And once you reach that stage, you know, the late Father Malachi Martin used to call them the perfectly possessed. You're dealing with people that are capable of literally any kind of deception that you can imagine. So whether that unfortunate individual was real or if somebody threw a dummy out or it was photoshopped, the point is, regardless of what the actual reality or lack thereof of that picture may be, the picture itself is there and has become a part of the ritual. That is, again, classic social engineering occult practice.
And such a prominent thing, because I think there was a documentary called Falling Man, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think you're right.
So it became a prominent, thing.
It became
that day.
It became a meme in its own right.
Wow. So, well, Dr. Farrell, I want to thank you for spending so much time with me. Looking at the sheer volume of your work, you're obviously a very busy man.
Yeah,
and you've done several interviews. You mentioned you did a few interviews today already, and you spent so much time with me this evening. I really appreciate it.
Well, you're more than welcome. Thank you for having me on.
And thank you. And perhaps sometime in the future, I'll give you a break, of course, but I'll send you an invite after I get through your Common Core book. I'd like to discuss that with you.
So, sure, absolutely.
I really appreciate it, and I want to wish you a good night then.
Yep, you too. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.